Today we're going to be learning what's called Living in Divine Space. And this, many of the teachings that we're going to be learning come from a book from Rav Ginsberg of the same title. And today we're going to be learning about Jewish meditation in a more general way. And then we're going to spend substantial time in a specific meditation, which is called Living in Divine Space. And it's very, very connected to this month. If you remember, in the last class, I mentioned this idea of the cities of refuge are very, very connected to the month of Elul. So, just to review, we said that there are six cities of refuge. And on a spiritual level, like every mitzvah in the Torah, we have to ask, what does it mean to me? We don't have Ari Miklat anymore. So then the question is, as with all mitzvot, so then how do I understand this? Why do I need to learn this? What can I glean from this? So the Ari Miklat, as we said, represent this idea of finding a space, a safe haven where one can go in order to be alone with oneself and alone with God. This is what Rabbi Nachman called Hitz Bodedut. And it has a thousand applications where we find that place or how we find that place. Everyone is different. And everyone will find their Ari Miklat. Some people find it in prayer. Some people find it in nature. Some people find it in music. Some people find it with a therapist. And I'm not saying that facetiously. But everyone finds their place that they can open up and have that safe place. And as we said, the six cities of refuge relate to Elul being the sixth month of the year. And we go to a city of refuge when we're being chased by, it's called the Goel Dam, by the blood redeemer who wants to kill us. This is symbolically the Yetzer Hara. But we can use many other names. It's our own ghost in our closet. Whatever we want to call it. Guilt is a good name for it. Or a feeling of inadequacy. And we all have our blood redeemers chasing after us. Memories of the past mistakes. And so therefore, Elul, we want to find a safe place. In the introduction of a book called Sefer HaChinuch, which is a very, very important book because it's basically according to the Rambam. It goes to the 613 mitzvot and very beautifully gives us the philosophical underpinnings of the mitzvah. And then, how do you actually do the mitzvah on the practical level? And if it's the kind of mitzvah we don't do today, it still explains, how do you do the mitzvah? So it's a wonderful book because it really tells us the practical to the philosophical. And in the introduction, he discusses a important concept in the Rambam, which is the idea that there are six continual mitzvot. Shesh mitzvot tamidiyot. The six mitzvot are the belief in the existence of God, not believing in other gods, belief that God is one, love of God, fear or awe of God, and not straying after negative thoughts. So he mentions in the introduction the idea that there are these six continual mitzvot. They apply to every person at every time in every place. And then he says, without any explanation, he says, and this is alluded to in the six cities of refuge. And he explains no more. So the meditation that we're going to be learning is how to take these specific six mitzvot in order to create a city of refuge, a safe haven, a spiritual retreat place that we can go to through these six mitzvot. These six mitzvot and meditating on them create this space. And this is the meditation that we're going to be learning. We're going to be learning how to do it and what to do with it. It's an incredible type of meditation. According to Rav Ginsburg, it is the most basic of all Jewish meditation. As he said, this is the ground floor of any further meditation. This is where we have to start. And you'll see in that there's connections, all kinds of connections with the directions and the spirit and inner sense and different souls in Jewish history. We'll get into all of that. So that's the idea. When we say living in divine space, is not just this, but specifically this, where our meditation creates a space in which we can accomplish what we want from the meditation. But before we can do that, we need to understand some of the basics of Jewish meditation and meditation in general. So first of all, the Lubavitcher Rebbe said that there are really three basic types of meditation. One, he said, is a type of meditation where the purpose is to relax, to create a certain feeling of peace and inner contentment, of being centered. In Hebrew it's called Yishuv HaDat, of coming to a place of centeredness and mature reaction to things. And he said this is very legitimate. Very legitimate. There are many, many ways to come to this place of relaxation or peace. Through breathing, through concentrating on a word or a phrase, of conjuring up a visualization. But the idea is to get to this place, and in that place one feels their soul, begins to feel their soul. So he said this is one type of meditation. A second type is what he called Shviti Hashem Lenegdi Tamid. I will place God before me at all times. In other words, the purpose of the meditation becomes to come close to and experience a relationship and a feeling of presentness of God. And the third type is a type of meditation where one contemplates the mysteries of the Torah. Now, anytime you make a comparison with other religions or methods or philosophies, there's a tendency to make value judgments. So, following what I'm saying, that there are no value judgments here. There are different structures, there are different techniques, different methods. But what I'm trying to point out is, let's say, the difference between Jewish meditation and other forms of meditation. Now, certainly the third type of meditation, in contemplating the mysteries of the Torah, is uniquely Jewish. And this is done through meditating on the letters, meditating on names of God, meditating on verses in the Torah, or personalities in the Torah. This is what's called, in our evening prayers, it says, Ubehem Nehegeh Yomam V'Laila. In them you shall meditate day and night. That's the word that Art School uses. Art School uses the word meditate. And this is very, very important, because Art School is not per se a mystical translation of the text. But it says in them, what are the them? Words of Torah. In words of Torah, you should meditate day and night. And this is very, very important, because this is what we're talking about. Where when we learn Torah, there's learning Torah on, as we call it, an outside level, more superficial. I learn what to do and how to do it and when to do it. And I might even learn some of the reasons that we do the mitzvah. But then there's a level where we begin to meditate on what we learned. That's when it becomes panemius, when it gets inside. Where I meditate on the mysteries of the Torah. Ubehem nehegeh yomam v'layla. We're saying that there's a level of learning Torah, or really anything in life, truthfully. Learning what to do, how to do, when to do it, where to do it, and even learning the deeper reasons, or some of them, but never meditating on them until the term is we take ownership of them, until we understand it in a deep, deep way. And that's what it means. Ubehem nehegeh yomam v'layla. We shouldn't just learn, but we have to meditate until it reaches the deepest levels of our intellect, our soul, and our heart. So that, we say, is a unique type of Jewish of meditation. It's totally dependent on the words of Torah. So we said that kind of meditation is where we meditate on letters. We meditate on names of God. We meditate on verses. Let's say Shema Yisrael. So we say Shema Yisrael twice a day. But the question is, how many of us have taken 15 minutes to really think about every word and what it really means, and to meditate on it? Now, obviously, some people have taken classes and learned a lot about Shema Yisrael. But most people mostly learn what to do and how to do it, and not necessarily have ever deeply thought about what we're learning. So that's a specific Jewish meditation. And according to Rav Ginsburg, this is where new insight comes from. Going back to the first level. So we said that there is a value in just sitting and breathing deeply and imagining a cool stream running in the mountains in the peace that we feel there. So that has a value of its own and is important. But in many different forms of meditation, that becomes the means and the end. Now that is the purpose of meditation, is to feel peace. So the way we're learning it is that becomes just the beginning of meditation. In other words, to clear one's mind and stop the racket and the static. And if we can use the analogy of a radio, in other words, to get onto a wavelength and not in between, it's all static. And that wavelength is that we're concentrating on a word or a picture or a concept. At least we're on a clear station. But this is only the beginning of Jewish meditation. It's not the end. The second of contemplating God So in a certain way, this is not uniquely Jewish, but is very, there are parts that are uniquely. Why? Is in Eastern meditation, again, without getting into the differences of Hinduism and Buddhism and Shintoism and all Confucianism, all this, but, and again, before you came, I said, I'm saying this with no value judgments. It's not like this is good and this is not good. It's not what we're saying. But it's different. In other words, Jewish meditation is God-oriented. In many of the other systems, it's self-oriented. In other words, I want to get to the deepest level of myself, self-realization. Now, this also is positive. Why? It's because the more I reach true self-realization, the more I realize about God. The more I realize about God, the more, and as in a pre-class we just learned, that the soul is an actual part of God. So if I understand more about God, almost by definition, I can understand a little bit more about myself. But in many different types of meditation, the purpose is self-realization. And in many of these other forms of meditation, there is not a belief in a personal God. There is a belief in a spiritual energy of the universe that takes care, everything works itself out. I don't know if anyone has seen the newest fad is the word, but the newest rage is The Secret. Mm-hmm. Right? The Secret is the new rage. I watched it twice myself, and my conclusion was halfway through the first time, but I wanted to watch it because when I teach, like everyone else is watching, I have to know what to say here. So there are many, many positive points of The Secret. Many, many points that Torah would say, not exactly the same way, but very close. Very close. And for many people, I could see this is very, very positive. But there are also some very, very negative messages there and things that were very not Jewish. But if you noticed in the whole thing, there might have been one reference, but consistently was the universe will give you what you need. The universe, the energy of the universe, everything works itself out. There's a give and a take and the law of attraction, and you put out an energy, you'll get it back. Okay, so we have concepts like that too. Mida keneged mida, a very, very important part of Jewish thought. But I just noticed, I think one person mentioned God. Okay, so just to finish this idea, that, like I said, I'm not making value judgments there. There is a place for self-realization and meditation. But that's not the focus. That's not the focus of Jewish meditation. Jewish meditation is God-oriented. And when we meditate on the Torah, that's also God-oriented, because we believe that God gave us the Torah, and it's a reflection of God's will and wisdom. So that's also. But the point that Rav Sholem made is a very, very good point. And and we see this in a story. It's called Arba Shenichnasu LaPardes. The four that went into the Pardes, into the mystical orchard, really, of meditation. And we're told that four went in after literally a lifetime of preparing to elevate themselves to these high, 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 high levels. And we're told that only Rabbi Akiva went in peace and came out in peace. One went crazy, one died, and one became a heretic. And so before they went in, Rabbi Akiva said to them, when you get to the place of pure marble, don't say water, water. And then he quoted a verse saying, those who tell lies will not stand, will not make it. What was he alluding to? He was alluding to, and this is one of the deepest teachings that I ever learned from Rav Ginzburg, is the following. He said like this, he said, you would think that the more Torah I know, the more mitzvahs I do, the more I know about God, the clearer everything will get. He said, it's not true. He says, the more you know, the more paradoxical everything gets. Why? Because the essence of God is paradox. So the more you know, the more Torah you know, the more you connect to God, the more paradoxical everything gets. This is not a negative statement. By other people are scared of paradox. We're not scared of paradox. And we can see that in the symbol of the mug and David. The mug and David is a symbol of paradox. You have one triangle going in one direction, and you have the other going the absolute opposite direction, and they're intermingled. That becomes a symbol of dealing with paradox. So that's what Rabbi Akiva meant. When you get to the place of pure marble, in other words, when you get to a place where you think is now going to be, this is it, a lifetime to get to a pure vision of God, he said, you're going to be amazed what you're going to see. You're going to think it will be all clear. So he said, don't say water, water. Don't think what you're seeing is duality, because it's going to appear like paradox, like duality. He says, because in that place, if you call what's really unity duality, you won't make it. But what I'm saying this is really just to understand that it was Rabbi Akiva who went into peace and came out in peace. And they asked, why was that? It wasn't just that he could deal with the paradox. Is it because when he had the elevation of soul, he knew that its purpose was to bring that realization that he would get in that place back down and use it in the world. Because we've all heard the concept Yirida, the Tzorach Aliyah, going down in order to go up. The soul comes down into the body in order to actually have an elevation. Or like the Baal Shem Tov says, if you want to help someone out who's in a pit and he's full of mud, sometimes you have to go down and you have to go and drag him out. So you have to go down in order to come up. So Rav Ginzburg said, there's a higher level. That's going up in order to come down. And like Rav Sholem said very rightfully, that is what Jewish meditation is. So it's not that people who don't do Jewish meditation, they don't take what they learn and bring it back. But still, it's self-centered, it's self-oriented. I want the experience of peace of mind. I like this experience. It is good for me. It turns me on. But it's not easily translatable. So how can I now use that to fix the world? Because that ultimately is the mission of the Jewish people. Remember we learned last class, when a soul is relating to the world, the way we relate is, how can I fix the world? How can I heal the world? How can I uplift the world? And so therefore, the purpose of Jewish meditation is not the experience itself. This is a very, very important point. and this runs through a lot of things, that there's the tendency to get caught up in the experience. And this was for sure by Reb Shlomo, is that Reb Shlomo would create an experience. And this is a very positive thing. The experience was that we would feel the depths of our neshama. We'd feel close to other Jews. You know, hundreds of thousands of people singing to you. You feel close to other Jews. You feel close to God. You feel good about yourself. There was an experience there. But, in Reb Shlomo's own words, too many times people got so lost or engrossed in the experience that they weren't really hearing what he was saying. The experience like overwhelmed everything. So this idea, I mean, you know, we're living in a culture in the world that is fixated on experience. Is fixated on instant gratification. I want experience, and I want it now, and I want it quickly, and I want it cheaply, and I want it easily, and I want a lot of it. Because as soon as it wears off, I need more. I need more. So really, media is a type of drug for many people. For many, many people, and I'm not saying this loosely, a lot of people, it's like you turn off the TV, they don't know what to do with themselves. They really don't. Right? And if they're not either doing something that's distracting them, they don't know what to do with their time. Mm-hmm. I mean, people read, you know, detective novels, you know, hundreds of them, right? Reading is wonderful, but I'm just saying the motivation of the reading is I need to be distracted. My life is like is too painful, so I need a movie or a TV show or a drug or a drink or a party or a sport. I need something to distract. I need an experience. So meditation can also be an experience that's actually distracting me. But that's not Jewish meditation. Jewish meditation is goal-oriented. To be a better person, to be closer to God, to change the world. And in, especially the third type of meditation, which is uniquely Jewish, of meditating on the Torah, the purpose is new insight. That becomes the purpose of the Jewish meditation, is new insight. That through meditating on a verse or a mitzvah, and for example, like say you learn some chassidus on whatever, and then to sit for 5 minutes and like start to make connections. It's like while you're learning. Okay, you're learning it, you have to concentrate on the words. Okay, ideas are popping in the head. So that becomes the greatest learning. And that's what I want to get to right now, is that we shouldn't think that Jewish meditation means that you have to close your eyes and sit for an hour undisturbed. Learning, and that's what we're going to do right now, we're going to go through a series of different actions that are actually meditations, if we want to relate to it that way. I know that there's an aspect of it. So the first one I'll say is learning. When you're learning by yourself, and especially let's say with a chavrusa or with a teacher, and you're like totally focused and the teacher's focused, you're learning, what happens? The sparks start flying. Like, oh, you hit the tape, I never saw that before. Wow, what a building up. I've been learning this for, you know, this. I've seen this verse 100 times. Svi and I were learning yesterday, and this happened like 2 or 3 times. Like things that we've read 100 times. It's like, Like, it's just a new perspective, a new way of seeing it. And that becomes actually the goal of Jewish meditation, is new insight, new realization. Because then the idea is that with that new insight and realization, it will somehow move us to be a better person, to inspire others, whatever it is. But it's not like I'm going to keep it to myself. It becomes an idea of sharing. So learning actually is one of the deepest benefits. And we don't do that with our eyes closed. We sit with a text. You can be in a class with 100 people, but the key is being focused. The key to all meditation is focus. Once you're focused, then that opens up all these gates, all these dimensions. So that one I mentioned about learning. Prayer, especially according to Hasidic understanding of prayer. Prayer becomes a deep meditation. There's so many stories of rabbis who took hours davening shacharit every day. Of people who don't take just 3 minutes to say the Shemona Esrei, but take 10 or 12 or 15 minutes. Of rabbis, you can shake lulav in less than a minute. You can. But many of the rabbis would shake lulav for hours. They would shake lulav for hours. It says in the Mishnah that they were called the Hasidim HaRishonim. The first Hasidim would meditate for an hour before prayer, would pray for an hour, and would meditate for an hour after prayer. These are what we call the Hasidim HaRishonim, the first Hasidim. But here, prayer in general becomes a meditation. Mm-hmm. And the specific words of prayer become a meditation. Now, this has hundreds of different forms. The Arizal created a highly complicated form of what I call kavanot, which will bring us to the next type of meditation, where virtually every word in the prayer, there were names of God that were connected or would help come to a deeper understanding of that word or verse or blessing. And this is, very, very highly complicated, but the theory behind it is every word is hiding deeper and deeper different levels of meaning. And through these different kavanot literally means focused intention, that one could open it up to new and new levels. So therefore, that's why people spend hours on davening, because it's not because it takes them a long time. It's because they're meditating on each word, each verse. We already mentioned kavana. This is a very important one. Kavana means intended focus on what we're doing. It's especially mentioned with mitzvah and prayer. And there's two levels of kavana. There's more of a halachic understanding of kavana and a more spiritual. The halachic definition, in a narrow sense, is when I do a mitzvah, I should be aware that at this moment I am doing a mitzvah. Meaning, when I'm about to light Hanukkah candles, I'm not lighting candles to bring light into the room. I'm lighting them specifically because there is a mitzvah to light candles. When I say Shema, And when I say the Shema, there's a mitzvah in the Torah to say Shema twice a day. And what I'm about to do is, my kavana is to fulfill the mitzvah. So that is what kavana means in a more narrow halachic terms. But in Jewish thought, it's been expanded to mean the deeper meanings of what we're doing. In other words, we can do mitzvot with very little kavana.
Mm-hmm.
We can. Or we can do mitzvah with a lot of kavana. So the idea of doing mitzvah with a lot of kavana, this becomes a meditation. But we're so plugged into our preconception that meditation must mean at least a half an hour, 20 minutes. How can you even talk about meditation taking 10 seconds? But we're talking about Jewish meditation here. So in other words, if I am about to light my Shabbos candles or my Hanukkah candles, but before I do, I just take 5 seconds, 10 seconds, a minute, and I think, what am I doing? And I think of everything I've learned about this mitzvah I'm doing. And I think about how it affects my soul and how it can get me close to God and how it can help me fix the world. So it only needs to take 10 seconds. Is why? Because I'm totally focused right now.
Mm-hmm.
Just like sometimes it takes a long time to clear the mind. Like, for example, everyone is different. I personally have an extremely difficult time sitting and clearing my mind. It's just, I can do it. It's extremely difficult. But it comes very natural to me for a minute or two or three to be able to focus all my energies to a specific mitzvah that I'm about to do, or a specific letter, or a specific word. Everyone's different. So a meditation is also kavana. Or let's put it this way, we can turn kavana into a meditation. And so in the quantum physics talks about time dilation, where depending on the factors or the gravity or the velocity, time can be infinitely expanded or shrunk. So therefore, a minute can seem to last a lifetime. We've all had those experiences, right? Or the opposite. A whole summer can fly by like that, in our subjective experience of it. So kavana is like that. In other words, I'm about to daven, I'm about to learn, I'm about to do this mitzvah, and you can take 15, 20 seconds, but what you can pack into those 20 seconds is awesome. It's really awesome. Then we have dance, where dancing can become a meditation. That's why in traditional circle, literally, it's circle dancing. And people are holding hands and singing the nigun. And the body becomes part of the meditation. That's also shuckling when we daven. That our bodies also have a wisdom to it. Our bodies also have a language to it. And so therefore, Rabbi Nachman used to teach, Rabbi Shlomo used to quote this a million times, there's happiness when you're singing, but you know when you're really happy is when you can dance. Right? So we've all had the experience, let's say, on Shabbos or at a wedding. So everyone's dancing, and you can gauge your level of happiness is, are you dancing at the wedding? And if you're dancing, are you just kind of going through the motions of going in the circle? Or we've all had the experience where we really start dancing, right? And the dance becomes the reflection of our joy. Becomes a reflection of our joy. And then when the dance merges with the music, so again, it's not just having a good time. And it's not just experiencing joy. Where through the motion of our bodies, along with the music, we start experiencing new things. But a level that more people can relate to is that's music. Music is really one of the deepest of all meditations. And it was used by the prophets, and it was one of the main ways of achieving either prophecy or achieving a state in which a person could achieve prophecy. In other words, people would use music in order to get themselves in the space where they could receive prophecy. Where do we see this? We see this by what's called Simcha Beit HaShoeva. It's called the ceremony of drawing the water on Sukkot, where they would go in Jerusalem. Now it's outside of the walls, but it used to be inside of the walls, and they would draw from the Mei Shiloach, from the source of water, in I believe it was golden vessels, and they would literally sing and dance this vessel of water to the temple, and then they would sing and dance all night, literally all night, and then in the morning they would pour the water onto the altar. And the phrase in the Mishnah is, someone who has never seen the joy of this celebration has never seen joy. Now this is considered like the epitome, the paradigm of joy. So the question is asked, it's in Rambam, when it's called Simcha Beit HaShoeva, it's in the Gemara. So the literal meaning is the ceremony of drawing the water. But the Gemara says, what were they drawing? Ruach HaKodesh. They were drawing prophecy. That's what was happening. But how did it happen? Through the singing and the dancing. They aligned themselves to be able to receive prophecy. The other example, it's a beautiful story. I'm going to tell it like very, very quickly. When God told Shmuel that Shaul would be the first king and that he should anoint him, when Shmuel told Shaul, he didn't believe it. He was very humble, and he couldn't believe that God had chosen him to be king. And Shmuel kept on saying, no, God has chosen you, and he wouldn't believe it. So he said to him, I'm going to leave now, and I'm going to give you a series of signs, and they're going to all happen to you, and I'm telling you this is to show you that when I tell you that God said that you should be, that you're meant to be king, you're meant to be king. And he leaves him, and everything that Shmuel said would happen to him happens to him. And the last sign was, you will come upon a band of prophets, and they will be playing music, and you will begin to prophesy too. And sure enough, he comes upon a band of prophets, and they're playing music, and he begins to prophesy. And the story ends that a phrase was coined in Israel, because Shaul was known, he was not known as a person but to reach prophecy. He was like, this is not the type that you would think would be a prophet. So people started saying, is Shaul also among the prophets? Like, they couldn't believe that he also reached prophecy. But the main part of the story is, it was through the music that they reached prophecy. And of course, we know about David and Melech, that the Psalms, even though we're used to saying the Psalms, they were written as songs. And of course, Rav Shlomo helped us reconnect to that level where these are meant to be sung. Just like in the Beit HaMikdash, the Levim were singing, right? They were singing all the time. And just a few more ideas, and then I actually want to put it all together with the music, that we'll be able to take music and in our own way meditate to the music and let it carry us to wherever we need to go. So we mentioned that there are different words for meditation. And the two that I'm going to mention are hit bodedut and hit bonenut. Most people associate hit bodedut with Rabbi Nachman. But we have to know that this word was used in Kabbalistic text for up to 2,000 years before Rabbi Nachman. And it was the now this is, you should know that this is according to Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan. Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan is very, very, very strong in the opinion that the most proper word for meditation and Jewish meditation is hit bodedut. From the word to be alone, levad, boded, to be alone. And the dual meaning of that is the idea of what we're going to be learning with this specific meditation, of how to create a space where you could be alone. But it's also the idea that we're very familiar with, that in order to properly meditate, we do have to extricate ourselves from extraneous thoughts. Now, we have to isolate ourselves. And that's what hit bodedut means. To be alone also means to isolate our thought process so that we can reach higher levels of consciousness and be aware of higher levels of soul. The other word is hit bonenut, from the root bina or bona. Bina means to understand, and bona means to build. So I'll say elu ve'elu divrei Elohim chayim, these and these are the words of the living God. Rabbi Ginsberg feels that hit bonenut is the proper word for meditation. Now, they both recognize the other word as being important. It's only a nuance here as to what is the more, let's call it, authentic word for meditation in a Jewish sense. So according to Rabbi Ginsberg's view of it, the root of hit bonedun, again being bina and bonah, which means to understand and to build, is the idea that we've mentioned, that the purpose of meditation is to come to a new level of understanding, have new levels of insight, and to bona, to build something from that that we can then use, and not just have the experience of peace of mind, which has a value in itself, but that we actually build from the new insight something that we can use. The idea of to build is a very practical connotation to it. So they're both true. They're both true. They both have aspects that are meaningful and true. And just a few other ideas of ways of meditating is one of these was revealed by a very, very special and a little bit of a controversial figure is Rabbi Avraham Abulafia. Rabbi Avraham Abulafia lived in the middle of the 1200s, and for better or for worse, he lived right before the Zohar was revealed. And he began to reveal methods of meditation that were very new to people. And many people questioned whether he had an authentic tradition or he was not making it up, but he was just like creating something from scratch. And in his day, he was controversial because many people didn't know what to make of him. As centuries have gone by and generations, as is usually the case, people have realized more and more that he had a very authentic tradition. And what he was teaching was not just valuable, but unique. Rabbi Avraham Abulafia had a very unique type of meditation, which is based on the letters. And taking letters and words and what we're doing was called siruthin, changing them around to see what comes out of them. Now, later they realized, because the book Tikkuni Zohar, everyone's heard of the Zohar, but there's another book called Tikkuni Zohar. The entire book, and it's quoted everywhere in Kabbalah, the entire book is on one word, Bereshit. And it takes the six letters of Bereshit and switches them around to make different words. And then explains what these words mean in relationship to Bereshit. So, but this is what Avraham Abulafia taught. But he taught it as a meditative tool. And, you see, the method is used throughout Kabbalah. And it's used in the Gemara all the time also. The more standardized version, Gemara says, don't read a word this way, read it that way. In other words, let's say you have three letters. So it says, don't read it this way. We'll take out one letter and we'll put in another letter, or we'll add a letter and we'll read it this way in order to have new understanding. The Gemara, actually, if you go through the entire Shas, says it hundreds of times. Hundreds of times. It says, don't read it, al tikra X, Ella, Y. But Avraham Abulafia taught it openly as a way of meditating. That you would meditate on these word permutations. Now, it's actually a very, very acceptable idea. But when he came out with it, it was controversial. Okay, so I'm just going to end with the following. That a word that spells out levad, which is the root of heath bodadu, is b'chol libi derashticha. With all of my heart I have sought you out. This is David HaMelech speaking to God. With all of my heart I have sought you out. And Rav Ginsburg mentions also that even though we tend to think of meditation, and especially a lot of the meditation we've talked about is being very intellectual, which again, Eastern meditation we would not call intellectual, whereas Jewish meditation is highly intellectual. Yet, the goal is to bring it into the heart. And so therefore, the first letters of these three words, B'chol Libi Zereshticha, spelled out Levad, which is the root of Hit Bodedut, which is meditation. So he said, like we said before, the idea of going up in order to come down. So therefore, we elevate in meditation, but ultimately we have to bring it into our heart. Now, and that really means it needs to be integrated into our emotions and the way that we act in the world. So I'll end with a bracha and one song here that hopefully we can take what we just learned and can think to ourselves, because everyone has their niche where they can turn something into a more meditative practice. Some people can do it with prayer, some people can do it with study, some people can do it with music, some people can do it with art. Art can also turn into a meditation, but the art just carries us. And all the other things that we mentioned, all the other things that we mentioned can become a form of meditation. Kavana, visualization, yichudim, meditating on different ways of uniting with God. So we should all have the blessing as we prepare for Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Hashanah Rabbah, Simchat Torah, to be able to take these teachings and integrate them into our praying. And in between prayers, and we're all sitting there and like contemplating and involved in introspection, that we can use these ideas, which next week we're going to get into real specifics. We're going to now take these general ideas and apply them to a specific meditation that everyone can have in their back pocket and have it, you know, for a lifetime, in order to experience it. We're learning about that this meditation, which is based on six continual mitzvot, is connected to what are called the six cities of refuge. The six words of Shema become this spiritual force field that when we say it with the proper kavana and intent kavana, we're creating around us a force field. That is, I didn't mention those actual words, force field, but that is what this meditation does. It creates a force field around us, and we're in the middle. That's the whole thing. Beautiful. Okay, so if everyone will just focus on the sounds coming out here, but especially focus on what we just learned. Whatever touched you, whatever seemed new to you, or what you could actually use, that's it. That's what you should focus on.
not so much.